Chapter 33. In which the story pauses a little, this rector of Broxton is little better than a pagan. I hear one of my readers exclaim, how much more edifying it would have been if you had made him give Arthur some truly spiritual advice. You might have put into his mouth the most beautiful things quite as good as reading a sermon. Certainly I could, if I held it the highest vocation of the novelist, to represent things as they never have been, and never will be. Then, of course, I might refashion life and character entirely after my own liking. I might select the most unexceptionable type of clergyman, and put my own admirable opinions into his mouth on all occasions. But it happens, on the contrary, that my strongest effort is to avoid any such arbitrary picture, and to give a faithful account of men and things as they have mirrored themselves in my mind. The mirror is doubtless defective, the outlines will sometimes be disturbed, the reflection faint or confused. But I feel as much bound to tell you as precisely as I can what that reflection is, as if I were in the witness box, narrating my experience on oath. 60 years ago it is a long time, so no wonder things have changed. All clergymen were not zealous. Indeed, there is reason to believe that the number of zealous clergymen was small, and it is probable that if one among the small minority had owned the livings of Broxton and Hayslip in the year 1799, you would have liked him no better than you like Mr. Irwin. 10 to 1, you would have thought him a tasteless, indiscreet, methodistical man. It is so very rarely that facts hit that nice medium required by our own enlightened opinions and refined taste. Perhaps you will say, do improve the facts a little then, make them more accordant with those correct views which it is our privilege to possess. The world is not just what we like. Do touch it up with a tasteful pencil, and make believe it is not quite such a mixed and tangled affair. Let all people who hold unexceptionable opinions act unexceptionably. Let your most faulty characters always be on the wrong side, and your virtuous ones on the right. Then we shall see at a glance whom we are to condemn, and whom we are to approve. Then we shall be able to admire, without the slightest disturbance of our prepossessions. We shall hate, and despise with that true ruminant relish which belongs to undoubting confidence. But, my good friend, what will you do then with your fellow parishioner who opposes your husband in the vestry? With your newly appointed vicar, whose style of preaching you find painfully below that of his regretted predecessor? With the honest servant who worries your soul with her one failing? With your neighbor, Mrs. Green, who was really kind to you in your last illness, but has said several ill-natured things about you since your convalescence? Nay, with your excellent husband himself, who has other irritating habits besides that of not wiping his shoes? These fellow mortals, every one, must be accepted as they are. You can neither straighten their noses, nor brighten their wit, nor rectify their dispositions. And it is these people amongst whom your life has passed that it is needful you should tolerate, pity, and love. It is these more or less ugly, stupid, inconsistent people whose movements of goodness you should be able to admire, for whom you should cherish all possible hopes, all possible patience. And I would not, even if I had the choice, be the clever novelist who could create a world so much better than this, in which we get up in the morning to do our daily work, that you would be likely to turn a harder, colder eye on the moldy streets and the common green fields on the real breathing men and women, who can be chilled by your indifference or injured by your prejudice, who can be cheered and helped onward by your fellow feeling, your forbearance, your outspoken, brave justice. So I am content to tell my simple story, without trying to make things seem better than they were, dreading nothing, indeed, but falsity, which, in spite of one's best efforts, there is reason to dread. Falsehood is so easy, truth so difficult. The pencil is conscious of a delightful facility in drawing a griffin the longer the claws, and the larger the wings, the better. But that marvelous facility which we mistook for genius is apt to forsake us when we want to draw a real unexaggerated lion. Examine your words well, and you will find that even when you have no motive to be false, it is a very hard thing to say the exact truth, even about your own immediate feelings, much harder than to say something fine about them which is not the exact truth. It is for this rare, precious quality of truthfulness that I delight in many Dutch paintings, which lofty-minded people despise. I find a source of delicious sympathy in these faithful pictures of a monotonous, homely existence, which has been the fate of so many more among my fellow mortals than a life of pomp, or of absolute indigence, of tragic suffering, or of world-stirring actions. I turn, without shrinking, from cloud-born angels, from prophets, sibyls, and heroic warriors, to an old woman bending over her flower pot, or eating her solitary dinner, while the noonday light, softened perhaps by a screen of leaves, falls on her mob cap, and just touches the rim of her spinning wheel, and her stone jug, and all those cheap common things which are the precious necessaries of life to her, or I turn to that village wedding, kept between four brown walls, where an awkward bridegroom opens the dance with a high-shouldered, broad-faced bride, while elderly and middle-aged friends look on, with very irregular noses and lips, and probably with quart pots in their hands, but with an expression of unmistakable contentment and goodwill. Oh, says my idealistic friend, what vulgar details! What good is there in taking all these pains to give an exact likeness of old women and clowns? What a low phase of life! What clumsy, ugly people! But bless us, things may be lovable that are not altogether handsome, I hope. I am not at all sure that the majority of the human race have not been ugly, and even among those hordes of their kind, the British, squat figures, ill-shapen nostrils, and dingy complexions are not startling exceptions. Yet there is a great deal of family love amongst us. I have a friend or two whose class of features is such that the Apollo curl on the summit of their brows would be decidedly trying, yet to my certain knowledge tender hearts have beaten for them, and their miniatures flattering, but still not lovely, are kissed in secret by motherly lips. I have seen many an excellent matron, who could have never in her best days have been handsome, and yet as he had a packet of yellow love letters in a private drawer, and sweet children showered kisses on her sallow cheeks. And I believe there have been plenty of young heroes, of middle stature and feeble beards, who have felt quite sure they could never love anything more insignificant than a Diana, and yet have found themselves in middle life happily settled with a wife who waddles. Yes. Thank God. Human feeling is like the mighty rivers that bless the earth. It does not wait for beauty, it flows with resistless force, and brings beauty with it. All honor and reverence to the divine beauty of form. Let us cultivate it to the utmost in men, women, and children in our gardens and in our houses. But let us love that other beauty too, which lies in no secret of proportion, but in the secret of deep human sympathy. Paint us an angel, if you can, with a floating violet robe, and a face paled by the celestial light. Paint us yet oftener a Madonna, turning her mild face upward, and opening her arms to welcome the divine glory. But do not impose on us any aesthetic rules which shall banish from the region of art those old women scraping carrots with their work-worn hands, those heavy clowns taking holiday in a dingy pot house, those rounded backs and stupid weather-beaten faces that have bent over the spade, and done the rough work of the world, those homes with their tin pans, their brown pitchers, their rough curs, and their clusters of onions. In this world there are so many of these common coarse people, who have no picturesque sentimental wretchedness. It is so needful we should remember their existence, else we may happen to leave them quite out of our religion and philosophy and frame lofty theories which only fit a world of extremes. Therefore, let art always remind us of them. Therefore let us always have men ready to give the loving pains of a life to the faithful representing of commonplace things, men who see beauty in these commonplace things, and delight in showing how kindly the light of heaven falls on them. There are few prophets in the world, few sublimely beautiful women, few heroes. I can't afford to give all my love and reverence to such rarities. I want a great deal of those feelings for my everyday fellow men, especially for the few in the foreground of the great multitude, whose faces I know, whose hands I touch, for whom I have to make way with kindly courtesy. Neither are picturesque Lazarini or romantic criminals half so frequent as your common laborer, who gets his own bread, and eats it vulgarly but creditably with his own pocket knife. It is more needful that I should have a fiber of sympathy connecting me with that vulgar citizen who weighs out my sugar in a vilely assorted cravat and waistcoat, than with the handsomest rascal in red scarf and green feathers. More needful that my heart should swell with loving admiration at some trait of gentle goodness in the faulty people who sit at the same hearth with me, or in the clergyman of my own parish, who is perhaps rather too corpulent, and in other respects is not an Oberlin or a Tillotson, than at the deeds of heroes whom I shall never know except by hearsay, or at the sublimest abstract of all clerical graces that was ever conceived by an able novelist. And so I come back to Mr. Irwin, with whom I desire you to be in perfect charity, far as he may be from satisfying your demands on the clerical character. Perhaps you think he was not as he ought to have been a living demonstration of the benefits attached to a national church? But I am not sure of that. At least I know that the people in Broxton and Hayslip would have been very sorry to part with their clergyman, and that most faces brightened at his approach. And until it can be proved that hatred is a better thing for the soul than love, I must believe that Mr. Irwin's influence in his parish was a more wholesome one than that of the zealous Mr. Ride, who came there 20 years afterwards, when Mr. Irwin had been gathered to his fathers. It is true, Mr. Ride insisted strongly on the doctrines of the Reformation, visited his flock a great deal in their own homes, and was severe in rebuking the aberrations of the flesh. Put a stop, indeed, to the Christmas rounds of the church singers, as promoting drunkenness and too light a handling of sacred things. But I gathered from Adam Bede, to whom I talked of these matters in his old age, that few clergymen could be less successful in winning the hearts of their parishioners than Mr. Ride. They learned a great many notions about doctrine from him, so that almost every churchgoer under 50 began to distinguish as well between the genuine gospel and what did not come precisely up to that standard, as if he had been born and bred a dissenter. And for some time after his arrival there seemed to be quite a religious movement in that quiet rural district. "But," said Adam, "I've seen pretty clear, ever since I was a young un, as religion's something else besides notions. It isn't notions sets people doing the right thing, it's feelings. It's the same with the notions in religion as it is with mathematics. A man may be able to work problems straight off his head as he sits by the fire and smokes his pipe, but if he has to make a machine or a building, he must have a will and a resolution and love something else better than his own ease." Somehow, the congregation began to fall off, and people began to speak light. "Oh, Mr. Ride, I believe he meant right at bottom. But, you see, he was sourish-tempered, and was for beating down prices with the people as worked for him, and his preaching wouldn't go down well with that sauce. And he wanted to be like my Lord Judge I the parish, punishing folks for doing wrong, and he scolded them from the pulpit, as if he'd been a ranter, and yet he couldn't abide the dissenters, and was a deal more set against them than Mr. Irwin was. And then he didn't keep within his income, for he seemed to think at first go off that 600 a year was to make him as big a man as Mr. Donathan. That's a sore mischief I've often seen with the poor curates jumping into a bit of a living all of a sudden. Mr. Ride was a deal thought on at a distance, I believe, and he wrote books, but as for mathematics and the natter o' things, he was as ignorant as a woman. He was very knowing about doctrines, and used to call them the bulwarks of the Reformation. But I've always mistrusted that sort o' learning as leaves folks foolish and unreasonable about business. Now Mr. Irwin was as different as could be. As quick, he understood what you meant in a minute, and he knew all about building, and could see when you'd made a good job. and he behaved as much like a gentleman to the farmers, and old women, and the laborers, as he did to the gentry. You never saw him interfering and scolding, and trying to play emperor. Ah, he was a fine man as ever you set eyes on, and so kind to his mother and sisters. That poor sickly Miss Andy seemed to think more of her than of anybody else in the world. There wasn't a soul in the parish had a word to say against him, and his servants stayed with him till they were so old and pottering, he had to hire other folks to do their work. Well, I said, that was an excellent way of preaching in the weekdays. But I dare say, if your old friend Mr. Irwin were to come to life again, and get into the pulpit next Sunday, you would be rather ashamed that he didn't preach better after all your praise of him. Nay, nay, said Adam, broadening his chest and throwing himself back in his chair, as if he were ready to meet all inferences. Nobody has ever heard me say Mr. Irwin was much of a preacher. He didn't go into deep spiritual experience. And I know there's a deal in a man's inward life as you can't measure by the square, and say, do this and that LL follow, apostrophe, and, do that and this LL follow, apostrophe, apostrophe. There's things go on in the soul, and times when feelings come into you like a rushing mighty wind, as the scripture says, and part your life into amist, so you look back on yourself, as if you was somebody else. Those are things as you can't bottle up in a do this and do that, and I'll go so far with the strongest Methodist ever you'll find. That shows me there's deep spiritual things in religion. You can't make much out why talking about it, but you feel it. Mr. Irwin didn't go into those things, he preached short moral sermons, and that was all. But then he acted pretty much up to what he said. He didn't set up for being so different from other folks one day, and then be as like him as two peas the next. And he made folks love him and respect him, and that was better nor stirring up their gall why being over busy. Mrs. Poyser used to say you know she would have her word about everything she said. Mr. Irwin was like a good meal o' victual, you were the better for him without thinking on it, and Mr. Ride was like a dose o' physic, he gripped you and worded you, and after all he left you much the same. But didn't Mr. Ride preach a great deal more about that spiritual part of religion that you talk of, Adam? Couldn't you get more out of his sermons than out of Mr. Irwin's? Eh, I know na. He preached a deal about doctrines. But I've seen pretty clear, ever since I was a young un, as religion's something else besides doctrines and notions. I look at it, as if the doctrines was like finding names for your feelings, so as you can talk of them, when you've never known them, just as a man may talk o' tools, when he knows their names, though he's never so much as seen them, still less handled them. I've heard a deal o' doctrine I my time, for I used to go after the dissenting preachers along Y Seth, when I was a lad o' 17, and got puzzling myself a deal about Arminians and the Calvinists. The Wesleyans, you know, are strong Arminians, and Seth, who could never abide anything harsh, and was always for hoping the best, held fast by the Wesleyans from the very first. But I thought I could pick a hole or two in their notions, and I got disputing why one o' the class leaders down at Treadlesson, and harassed him so, first o' this side, and then o' that, till at last he said, young man, it's the devil making use o' your pride and conceit as a weapon, to war against the simplicity o' the truth. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I couldn't help laughing then, but as I was going home, I thought the man wasn't far wrong. I began to see as all this weighing and sifting, what this text means and that text means, and whether folks are saved all by God's grace, or whether there goes an ounce o' their own will taught, was no part o' real religion at all. You may talk o' these things for hours on end, and you'll only be all the more cocky and conceited for it. So I took to going nowhere but to church, and hearing nobody but Mr. Irwin, for he said nothing but what was good, and what you'd be the wiser for remembering. And I found it better for my soul, to be humble before the mysteries o' God's dealings, and not be making a clatter about what I could never understand. And they are poor foolish questions after all, for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.